You are listening to Living Room on KPFA 94.1 FM. My name is C.S. Sung. Things happen in the real world. People lose their jobs or pensions. The gap between rich and poor widens. Folks find themselves in factories or office buildings doing nothing that interests them very much. Why? How do we explain things like unemployment or inequality of wealth or recession? Well, if the explainers are mainstream economists steeped in the ways of capitalism and prevailing neoliberal theory, you get one answer to the question why. But there exist other explanations that hardly get any media coverage, explanations that just might lead to changes in the way money and power and labor and everyday life goes on in this country. Because explanation can lead to awareness, which can sometimes lead to action. My guest today believes that orthodox economics is a dead end for understanding the world around us. He argues that there are other approaches rooted in the dynamism of the world economy that can better explain what's happening to capitalism and therefore to us, to you and me. His name is Michael Yates, and he's the author most recently of Naming the System, Inequality and Work in the Global Economy, just out from Monthly Review Press. He's also a labor educator, an associate editor of Monthly Review magazine, and for many years he was professor of economics at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown. Michael joins us now by phone from Portland, Oregon. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad you're with us. Before we get into radical economic theory, radical explanations, which I want to spend a good amount of time on today, let's talk about the mainstream or orthodox or what you call neoclassical economics, and how it explains a phenomena that have so much impact on our lives. What are the basic features of orthodox economics?
Well, I would say that orthodox economists basically see what happens in a society as the consequence of choices that individual actors in the economy make. In the economy, you basically have three sets of actors. You have consumers that buy goods and services, you have employers that hire workers, and you have workers looking for work. And each of these is presumed by the neoclassically or mainstream economists to be making what we might call maximizing choices. The employer's trying to maximize profit, and the consumer's trying to get the best deal for the money that he or she has, and the workers are trying to make the best combination of work and free time that they can. And as a consequence of all of these individual decisions, societal outcomes are determined as a consequence of them. These individuals are not really seen as part of any structure, part of any larger society. They're all seen as more or less isolated and independent individuals making free choices.
So in other words, self-interest runs the system and runs it the best that it could be.
They not only claim that societal outcomes, like whether there's inequality or whether there's unemployment or what have you, are the consequence of these individual choices, but they further say that if we had a society that was structured in such a way so that everybody could act with pretty much untrammeled selfishness, that we would have the best possible society.
There's also this question of the market. And I think this is where businesses and consumers meet, and also, I guess, workers and employers meet. And there's something about the impersonal nature of the market that you write about in your book that is a large part of this perspective as well.
Well, sure. Everybody makes independent individual choices. No one is impinged upon by anyone else, and they come together as free agents in the marketplace, so to speak, as suppliers or demanders, and they meet in the marketplace, and they make out more or less free deals, you know, and that determines, for example, the workers meet with their employers in the marketplace, and that determines the wage rate that the workers get and the amount of employment that the workers get. No one's really responsible for anything in the sense that there's no assumption that the employers are exploiting the workers or the workers aren't free to take whatever jobs are available. And so, yes, the markets are impersonal. People meet as independent individuals in these markets.
I think a lot of aspects of orthodox economics will come out as we talk about some specific examples, and you focus in your book on a number of issues of inequality and poverty in both the first world and, developing worlds. Let's talk about inequality of wealth between countries. How does orthodox economics go about explaining this?
I think they basically argue that all countries are on like steps of a ladder, and the rich capitalist countries have done certain things to make them rich, and the poor countries are on lower rungs of the ladder, and if they do the things that the rich countries did, then they'll become rich too, which basically means that they have to try to make their economies mimic this world in which everyone acts in a self-interested manner in the marketplace. And then if everybody in those poor countries does these things, and if the government doesn't do anything to impede them from doing these things, then these countries will become rich too.
So it's a question of productivity, and that poorer nations are just less productive than the richer nations?
Yes, exactly. They haven't structured their economies in such a way so that they can get maximum productivity. One argument you might say is that some countries, at least in the past and to some extent still today, are not sufficiently capitalist to develop. And so the first thing they have to do is they have to make their country sufficiently capitalist, which usually means that they have to put their agriculture on a capitalist basis. And when they begin to do that, then they'll start to develop. Of course, a lot of these countries now are in a position where they lack capital, so they have to get that. And so they have to do things which make it easy for the rich countries to provide them with capital. And then once they begin to use this capital in a capitalist manner, then they'll start to grow and to develop.
So I think you just started to critique the orthodox economic perspective or explanation for inequality between rich and poor countries. What's wrong with that analysis?
Well, let me give you a couple of examples, one dealing with people in a country and one dealing with the country itself. In the Philippines, there are thousands of people that make their living scavenging garbage dumps. And they live by the garbage dumps, and they make their living scavenging the garbage dumps. It's extraordinarily unpleasant work, as you can imagine, and very dangerous kinds of work. And they get things out of these garbage dumps, and then they try to sell them. Now, if we look at things from the orthodox economist's perspective, these garbage scavengers are in the position that they're in because of the choices that they've made. They're not productive enough to do better, and the reason that they're not productive enough is that they haven't made the kinds of choices to improve their productivity, like getting more schooling and what have you. Or they're not sufficiently enamored of consumer goods and services to work enough. Now, when you think about it, that just sounds preposterous, doesn't it? That people are working in garbage dumps because they haven't made the right choices. The Philippine society is structured in such a way, it seems to me, like all capitalist economies are, such that a small number of people own the society's wealth and everybody else doesn't. And the people that own the wealth structure the society in such a way so that they can maintain and increase their wealth. And as I'll probably explain as we go along, that inevitably leads to poverty and unemployment. The chances of these garbage scavengers being in a position where they could make the decisions that would make them rich, well, it's just ludicrous to imagine that that's going to happen. Their fate is sealed by the structure of the society. Now, if we looked at the Philippines, I think everybody would agree the Philippines is a pretty poor country. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of hunger. There's a lot of unemployment. There's a lot of underemployment whereby people scavenge as best they can, like these garbage dump scavengers. Now, the mainstream economist sees the Philippine economy as one that's not operating in a maximally efficient capitalist way. And then if it did the right things, if it opened up its economy to receive foreign capital, if it gave foreign capital appropriate incentives, then foreign capital would come in there and hire these workers and purchase the land and put it on a capitalist basis and begin to export goods and services and what have you.
Everybody happy.
Everybody would be happy, but the whole history of the Philippines is ignored by this analysis. In other words, the Philippines, just like the garbage scavengers, are in an unequal structure to start with. The Philippines is in an unequal structure to start with. And it's in the interest of rich countries to keep the Philippines at the bottom, just like it's in the interest of the well-to-do in the Philippines to keep these garbage scavengers at the bottom, because it makes them richer in the long run. That's all ignored, the history of colonialism in the Philippines, the history of imperialism in the Philippines. These kinds of things are all ignored, just like the structure of inequality inside the country is ignored, and all the focus is placed upon individual choice makers.
What about closer to home? We're talking with Michael Yates. He is a labor economist. For many years, he was professor of economics at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown. He's author most recently of a book called Naming the System, Inequality and Work in the Global Economy. And when he says naming the system, he means the system of capitalism, and it's been published by Monthly Review Press. What about wages and jobs? What does mainstream economics say about the effect of, say, minimum wages and living wages and union-negotiated wages? What does that have to say about, success of business and employment because of such initiatives?
Well, again, you always have to focus upon seeing the wage rate that exists in the market as the consequence of the individual maximizing choices of, in this case, employers and workers. So the way the mainstream economist sees it, let's say from the employer side of the market, from the demand for the workers side of the market, workers could be ranked, let's say, according to how productive they are. That is, if they were hired, how much would they add to the firm's revenue? And how much they add to the firm's revenue would be compared with how much the workers cost, what their wages is going to be. And since the employers are trying to maximize their profits to make as much money as they can, they're only going to hire those workers if their productiveness is greater than their cost. As you get down the queue of workers from the highest productive to the lowest productive, you're going to hire workers only so long as their productiveness is a little bit higher than their cost. So that means that the last workers hired are going to have a productiveness just above their cost. Now, let's suppose that the government enacts a higher minimum wage, or let's suppose that there's a movement to make a city pay a living wage like has happened across the country, or let's say that a union wins a higher wage. Well, then, according to the traditional economists, the cost is going to rise, and that means it's going to be above the productiveness of some workers, and so they're going to have to be laid off. So they think that the minimum wage, the living wage, that union-negotiated higher wages are bound to lead to unemployment, then hurt the very people that they were supposed to help.
Okay, so what do the statistics show? Do they show that places where there is minimum wage or a higher minimum wage, I should say, or a living wage or higher union negotiated wages, that there is more unemployment?
Raising the minimum wage certainly does not seem to lead to unemployment. The best study that I know of is a book written by two economists who were then at Princeton named Card and Kruger called Myth and Measurement. I think it's called New Economics of the Minimum Wage. And they performed innumerable sophisticated statistical tests, and they couldn't find it. In fact, it seemed to be that when you raise the minimum wage, employment went up, not down.
Goes up. Interesting.
They did a famous study where they compared fast food restaurants in New Jersey and Pennsylvania on the border, so that you would assume these, it's like a natural experiment. New Jersey raised the minimum wage because states are allowed to have minimum wages higher than the federal one, and Pennsylvania didn't. They replicated that study many, many times in many different parts of the country with many different samples of workers. They redid some of the older studies that neoclassical economists had done, and they found out that they had some basic flaws in them. Besides the minimum wage, well, there's also been some evidence by, I think, the economists Robert Pollan and Stephanie Luce at University of Massachusetts have done studies on these living wages, and they don't find losses of employment. Studies of union-negotiated wage increases don't show losses of employment. So the neoclassical propositions don't test out very well, but they still appear in the textbooks.
Okay, so if orthodox economics leaves a lot to be desired, then you go further in this book and you propose a radical theory, or you explicate a radical theory which has existed for some time, and Karl Marx could be said to be one of the main proponents or main figures to advance this view. There is a certain economic theory that he and his successors have put forward that involve a number of elements that perhaps help explain what's happening with capitalism and that's happening to you and me a little better. And let's talk about some of the key elements of Marxist theory. One is a capital accumulation and how much that drives the system of capitalism. Could you elaborate?
Let me say just to start with that. The radical economic perspective that associated with the name of Marx, which of course has been maligned so many times, it's unbelievable. That approach basically sees society not made up of isolated individuals, but as made up of social relationships. And that's really the key to the radical analysis, to see society as structured through a set of social relationships. And the key relationship, according to Marx, in a capitalist economy is that between the workers and their employers. That's the key. And Marx analyzes this relationship by starting off with this notion of the driving force of capitalism, which he calls the accumulation of capital. And that's put real simply, the drive by every employer, under pain of elimination from the market through competition, which is a key point, the drive of every employer to make as much profit as possible and to use that profit to grow as much as possible, to expand, to accumulate capital, Marx calls it. And that's like a law of capitalism, so to speak. Marx even compares it to like he uses an analogy of a religious law. He says, accumulate, accumulate. That is Moses and the prophets. And right off the bat, that tells us a lot. It tells us that at the core of society, of a capitalist society, is this drive to accumulate capital, to make money, to expand, to grow without limit. So that really gives us a key that capitalism is not going to know any boundaries.
And if workers and employers are then the key relationship in society, according to Marx, what do employers do to workers in order to accumulate capital and maximize profits?
That's really the key. So Marx poses a question, which I think is an extraordinarily good question and one of his deepest insights. Well, how is it possible to accumulate capital? How do you start out with one sum of money and convert it into a larger sum of money? And he sees that what complicates things in a capitalist economy is that there doesn't appear to be any, there's not the same kind of overt exploitation that you would see in a slave society or in a society where you have peasants living on a landlord's land and paying a rent and working on the lord's land. You know, you could see the exploitation in a society like that. You know what I mean? You could see the serfs carrying their produce to the lord. You could see them working on the lord's field. Slaves are obviously exploited. All the output goes to the slave owner. But in capitalism, the workers and the employers meet in the marketplace, and it doesn't look like there's any exploitation. So Marx says what we have to do is we have to leave the marketplace, and we have to go into the workplace, and we have to see what happens there. And he says when you do that, that gives you the key to how the employer is able to make profit and therefore accumulate capital. And although the theory is a little bit complicated for a radio interview, the long and short of it is that the employer is able to use its monopoly over society's wealth, you know, only a few people own most of it, to make the workers work a longer number of hours than it takes for them to buy the things that allow them to live. And this surplus value, as Marx calls it, is the source of the profit. So the profits essentially come from the exploitation of the workers, but the exploitation takes place in the workplace, not in the marketplace, sort of behind the back of the workers, so to speak. The workers think they're getting paid for a 10-hour day, but they're really not. They're getting paid some amount less than that. And the surplus then is used by the employer to accumulate. Furthermore, that what allows the surplus to continue without overt coercion on the part of the employers is that the employers structured our workplaces in such a way to create what Marx called a reserve army of labor, which I think is one of his other great insights, a pool of surplus workers that beat down the wages or put competition with the workers who are working. And so anytime the workers manage to push their wages up, the employers are able to restructure their workplaces in such a way so that a pool of unemployed workers pushes the wage down.
That suggests to me then that Marx would think that unemployment, that is, a readily available source of workers who could replace workers who, you know, want higher wages or want benefits that the employers are not willing to provide, that unemployment is an integral and essential and necessary feature of capitalism.
Well, I think that's exactly what Marx says and what I think is correct. I mean, employers are able to create this reserve army of labor by their normal actions. Mechanization is an obvious one that everyone would understand. That is, as wages are pushed up, the employer has an incentive to substitute machines for workers, and as employers do that, it pitches workers out into this reserve army of labor where they compete with everybody else and push wages down. Now, with the electronic revolution, that can take on extremes. You know, you can have clerical workers. Well, for example, the other day I called American Express up to see what my bill was for the month. And I don't know for sure, but my guess is that the woman who I was talking to was in India somewhere. And that's really common. The city of New York processes some of its some of the fines that it levies on people in Gone, I think. And then the results are transferred back electronically. So the electronic revolution pits workers everywhere against workers everywhere else. And that's one of the key mechanisms within a capitalist economy that helps keep wages down and allows the accumulation of capital to proceed.
My guest today is Michael Yates. He is author of Naming the System, Inequality and Work in the Global Economy. He is associate editor of Monthly Review magazine. For many years, he taught economics at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown. And the interesting thing is he's continued to be a labor educator, I think, for at least a couple decades. He's been teaching trade union members about economics and how it impacts their everyday life. And I think you've already, in a sense, Michael, begun to answer this question, but how then does radical economic theory view poverty and growing inequality? What is its explanation for these facets, attributes of capitalism?
Well, if you think of the society as structured in terms of this relationship between employers and workers, and the employers are trying to extract as much of the surplus out of the workers as they can, workers will become conscious of this in one way or another and will try to do something about it. So that really the best way to think of a capitalist economy is in terms of this conflict between employers and workers. And it takes on many, many dimensions and is a very complex thing that works itself out in different ways and in different places. But the struggle between employers and workers, you know, either side is victorious from time to time, but employers are in the driver's seat more or less. And if the power of employers increases, then you can expect poverty and unemployment to rise or inequality to increase. Where the workers are strong, then there'll be some reduction in it. So in my book, I argue that inequality has been growing for maybe 25 years anyway within the United States, within most of the advanced capitalist countries, and within the poor countries and between countries. Well, if you look at that period since about 1980, what's happened? Employers have been on the offensive everywhere. Workers have been on the defensive everywhere. And the consequences are pretty easy to grasp if you look at the society through the lens of radical economics, that as the power of the dispossessed goes down and the power of those that possess the means of production goes up, there's going to be more poverty, more inequality. Inequality has risen in the United States, and it's not coincidental that the percentage of the non-supervisory workforce in unions has gone down. I mean, there's like a direct correlation between the two. As unions weaken, programs that the state has enacted to benefit workers are harder to maintain.
Michael Yates writes that under capitalism, many people must be poor so that a few can be rich. Most must be insecure and afraid so that a few can face life with confidence. Nearly everyone must suffer a stunted existence so that a minority can enjoy life to the fullest. What about economic crisis? What about recession and depression? You write in your book, Naming the System, that orthodox economics would blame it on external factors like maybe oil prices or labor unrest. How do Marxists view crises within capitalism?
Well, they tend to see crises as internal to capitalism in the sense that crises are part and parcel of how a capitalist economy operates. Now, having said that, radical economists have a lot of disagreements as to what causes these crises. But basically, one easy way to think of it is that as a capitalist economy grows and accumulates capital, the power of workers increases. It becomes harder for employers to discipline them. This causes costs per car, per ton of steel to rise. It causes the surplus value to go down. It's harder to extract that surplus labor out of the workers the better the economy is doing. And as a consequence, you get a profit crisis. And a profit crisis means that profit margins start to shrink a little bit, and employers then cut back on their spending, on their accumulation of capital, and a recession or a downturn comes into being. The downturn can be exacerbated if there was a lot of debt during the upturn, and now the debt has to be paid back. Can be exacerbated by a lot of things. So some crises are more severe than others, but the crises themselves are unavoidable. They're sort of like, and the crises serve as, I guess the best way for listeners to think of it is that without a crisis, what's the disciplining mechanism that keeps workers' nose to the grindstone? You know what I mean? That keeps them willing to put in their work, to generate this surplus value, to be diligent, to get to work on time, to not be absentee, to work hard while they're at work. If there were full employment all the time within the framework of a capitalist economy, then what would keep workers' effort high? And one thing that a crisis does is that it redisciplines the workers, you know what I mean? It basically tells them, look, you're pretty insecure here. You better take what we're going to offer.
And the disturbing implication, of course, is that capitalists and the governments that are allied with them then like and want occasional crises in order to discipline labor. We have to move on. There's a lot of ground to cover still. I did want to point out that a lot of people on the left seem to believe that all these crises of capitalism will eventually herald the end of capitalism, that it'll promote worker dissatisfaction and people will rise up and all this. What do you see as economic crisis under capitalism as being a great opportunity for radicals?
Sometimes they can be, but I'm somewhat skeptical of that idea. It seems the best thing for radicals to do is to educate and to organize all the time. If crises come along and they can be utilized, then that's fine and dandy. But the idea that crises are going to lead to the inevitable collapse of capitalism, I think, is really wishful thinking. Capitalism is just an extraordinarily resilient economic system. I mean, it can suck in even revolutionary ideas into itself, you know. Like I say, you get advertisements that use the word revolutionary. You know what I'm saying? And so capitalism can defeat a lot of enemies and rebound from even the worst kinds of crises, like in the 1930s. So the idea that that crises are gonna set the stage, or that it's good if things got worse, I don't know. That seems to be a little bit wishful thinking to me. And that's a common kind of rhetoric, you know, that the next crisis is going to lead to this and going to lead to that. But I mean, workers can become more conservative in a crisis. You have to be worried about a job. You could, you know, if you haven't been properly educated, if you don't really understand what's going on, which is certainly true for a lot of people in the world, then crises might be a perfect time for people to start thinking in terms of scapegoats. And
or people could, as you write, drink heavily or hate themselves. Unemployment is as likely to make people do that as it is to make them revolutionaries. So let's talk about capitalism's weaknesses, because everybody tends to think it's such a strong system, and it is, and you write in naming the system that it's very resilient, that it's hegemonic and always expanding, and it has a certain repressive state apparatus around it that is designed to keep workers in their place so the system operates smoothly. And yet you do point that capitalism has certain contradictions or weaknesses which will just kind of naturally or logically generate a certain amount of opposition. What are some of those weaknesses?
Well, I mentioned a number of them. First of all, there are still a lot of parts of the world that are not completely capitalist, and in pre-capitalist societies, there's always a lot more collective ways of thinking and doing. So there's always that resistance, and we also have a certain collective memory ourselves, or remembrance of times when things were not completely isolated and individualistic and self-seeking. So that's one thing. I suppose one of the main ones, though, is that capitalism presents a society which is presumably free, in which everyone is free in the marketplace and faces each other as an equal in the marketplace, at arm's length, so to speak, in this impersonal market. And yet the reality of work life is a work life of unfreedom, because no one could say that you have freedom in the workplace. Well, we don't even have constitutional rights in our workplaces. We have no freedom of speech and so on and so forth. Our work is degraded and divided, and we're put on assembly lines, and we're pitched out of work. And so I suppose one of the most fundamental contradictions is that between the freedom that capitalism promises and the unfreedom, which is quite often its reality, and as they think about that, it's bound to hit them, they begin to think it's necessary to do something about it. And I think that's the foundation of labor movements and labor political parties and, you know, agitations against employers and even against the system itself. And it's impossible to eliminate that contradiction, it seems to me. It'll always be there, and it'll always be under the surface, and sometimes it'll come out into the open. That's a contradiction that cannot be resolved, it doesn't seem to me. The same thing is all human beings have the power to think about their work and to do it, to conceptualize and to execute. But the ability to conceptualize is denied to the overwhelming mass of people. So it's something fundamentally human denied to you. That's a contradiction that's bound to strike some people and cause them to resist or to react against it. So those are probably I would see as two of the main contradictions that generate resistance. And at certain times and certain places, these resistances can be successful, and they have been successful, and they offer us hope for the future, it seems to me.
Do you think the left has made a mistake in not, as your book indicates, naming the system of capitalism? Has it gone astray in focusing on neoliberalism?
Well, it's easy to understand. I mean, neoliberal policies are so awful and have wreaked so much damage in the world that it's easy to attack neoliberalism. And then, since a more liberal or Keynesian program has been put into effect and still exists in some countries, I mean, who could deny that workers on average are better off in Sweden than they are in the United States? But what has to be understood, it seems to me, is that those societies are still capitalist, and you have employers resisting those kinds of programs and trying to undermine them. And it might take 30 years, it might take 40 years, it might take 50 years, it might take 100 years, but they'll never give up. So it's much better to see that what's at root of the problem is the nature of the system itself, and to work to undermine the nature of the system, even as perhaps you try to, I mean, who would be opposed to more unemployment compensation or living wages? These are all good things.
Sure.
They all have to be fought for all the time. But you have to remember that the system will always try to undermine them, and so you have to be thinking in anti-capitalist terms as you promote certain kinds of reforms. You can't never imagine that the reforms themselves are going to do the trick. I understand it now, some of the in the anti-globalization movement are, you know, expressing more negative views towards capitalism itself and starting to see that as part of the problem. I mean, that might be more true in the poorer countries than, say, in the United States, but that seems to be happening. Now, what will come of that, since there are powerful forces of co-optation all the time, is an open question. But it seems to me, at least, that those on the left could offer strong support for Cuba, let's say, which has really done a wonderful job under the circumstances with all of its problems. And where there are actual revolutionary movements in effect, such as in Nepal, where you have a Mao-inspired communist movement, that it ought to be more publicized and given support, in addition to the obvious things like eliminate third world debt or, fight against monopolization of AIDS medication or eliminate sweatshops. Those are all good things, but other things ought to be supported too, and they all ought to be, you know, tied to an anti-system kind of a movement, it seems to me.
What about Brazil, Michael? What about Lula, the president, also known as Ignacio da Silva? He's been celebrated by many people on the left, former workers. A party leader, a current Workers' Party leader, would bring in progressive or radical theories and implement them. What's your sense of how well he's performed?
Well, it seems like not too well so far. In other words, he hasn't really been able to, I don't know the situation on the ground there really, but he hasn't implemented the kinds of more radical reforms like, say, repudiation of some debt or internally distributing land to the peasants, because there's a landless peasant movement there that was a strong element within the Workers' Party movement. I was a little worried because when I was living in Manhattan last year, there was a seminar, and one of Lula's top advisors gave a presentation there, and I was just wondering a little bit about it. You know, it didn't sound very radical to me. It sounded like co-optation had already begun, and that's sort of the impression I get of Lula. It's very difficult to take the helm of a country like Brazil and implement radical reforms when you don't control the military, when there hasn't been a revolution on the ground. I'm not sure that he couldn't do more things, but I don't know that we could expect a lot. What's necessary, I suppose, is to continue to support his movement underneath him, to see that movement as larger than him, and to continue to support its more radical elements, and not expect a whole lot from him, because perhaps he's not going to be able to accomplish much.
Right. Michael Yates's books include Why Unions Matter and Longer Hours, Fewer Jobs. His latest book, his last name is spelled, by the way, Yates, is Naming the System, Inequality and Work in the Global Economy. We have a link to that book on our website, livingroomradio.org. He's a labor educator, economist, former professor of economics at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown. We haven't even had time to ask him about his long-time discussions and instruction of trade union members into the ways of economics and really its practical effects. I think the word economics makes a lot of people's eyes glaze over, but it's about money, it's about power, it's about politics if you use the radical theory that Michael Yates is forwarding. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.